University Cornwall's 10th Annual Pride Parade and Festival is almost here. Join us on July 19th at Lamoureux Park in Cornwall for our free Pride Festival featuring live entertainment, a barbecue and beer tent, bouncy castles, face paint, carnival games, and more. To learn more about the festival or register for the parade, visit diversitycornwall.ca. University Cornwall would like to acknowledge the generous support of FedDev Ontario in making this event possible.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC, so thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to a group of graduate students who are participating in one of our special programs called the PhD Community Initiative. Welcome to Grad Chat, everyone.
Thank you.
It is great to have you all here. But before we talk about the PhD Community Initiative, it's probably a good idea if I get you all to introduce yourself. So perhaps you can say your name, what program you're in, and what kind of research that you're doing. And then we will get on to the program and the very specific project that you're talking about. So maybe, Kelechi, maybe you can start us off.
All right. Thank you, Colette. My name is Kelechi Kemnele. I'm a PhD candidate in the School of Kinesiology and Health Studies. My discipline is health promotion, and my research right now is focusing on exploring movement behaviors among school children in Antigua and Barbuda.
Priyanka, what about you?
So my name is Priyanka Yolmo, and I'm a PhD student in biomedical and molecular science, as well as in Sinclair Cancer Research Institute. So my research project is to investigate the role of immune cells in response to immunotherapy in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer.
Well, thank you. And Firuzan, what about you?
Hello. Very nice to meet you. I'm Firuzan Turki from Department of Biology at Molecular Biology, and right now I'm working on neuropeptide receptors and the potential ligands of two neuropeptide receptors of C. elegans, if you heard about that, and the potential ligand. These are somehow involved in some different pathways. We are not sure how many pathways they are involved, but we are looking to see where and how they are working in these pathways.
And Tanvi.
Hi, my name is Tanvi, and I'm doing a master's in biomedical informatics. So I am with the School of Computing as well as the Department of Biomedical and Molecular Sciences. And for my research project, I'm working with omic data related to pulmonary hypertension and just building data pipelines around analyzing big data and making it available for researchers in the pulmonary hypertension.
You've got a big project. Even though you're only doing a master's, you've got a very big project there.
Yeah.
And Sinta Yahu.
Yes, thank you. Hi, my name is Sinta Yawami, and I am a PhD candidate in the Rehabilitation Science Program under the supervision of Dr. Jordan Miller. My PhD thesis focus on the development and the pilot testing of interprofessional rehabilitation program for people with chronic low back pain in Ethiopia.
Thank you. And the last member of the team is actually the mentor of our team, who I don't think is able to actually connect, but I just want to mention none of these projects can, as we're going further, can go without having some great mentors that may have retired or still working and just want to sort of help out as well in some of these projects. So the mentor for our lovely little group here is Jeannie Sawyer. Yes, apparently you are enjoying retirement, looking at my notes here, so that is great. And it's nice to have someone like Jeannie who the whole purpose is to sort of help the group keep on track with the particular project, give some advice from time to time, but ultimately the project is for our students to do. But anyway, we're going to find out a little bit more about that in just a minute. So I'm just wondering, with the group then, who would like to talk to me a little bit about what is the PhD Community Initiative, just to enlighten everyone who is listening? Because I do mention it from time to time, but it's always good to have a little reminder. Who would like to talk about what is the PhD Community Initiative and why you wanted to be a part of it?
I can talk about the PhD Community Initiative. Actually, it's an innovation program offered by the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs at Queen's University. It's a co-curricular experiential learning opportunity where interdisciplinary teams of PhD students partner with community organizations to tackle pressing socioeconomic issues. We can say that the initiative combines the academic expertise with community-driven problem-solving to create meaningful, impactful changes. Yes, and this community pairs graduate students with the organization committed community development each year. This year, our group partnered with KFL and a public health to evaluate their communication strategies to prevent invasive meningococcal disease among post-secondary students, which my teammates will discuss it later in details. And we believe that this community, beyond the direct impact that has on the community, also benefits the PhD student like me by fostering teamwork, problem solving, and real world application of our research skills. It's a fantastic way, actually, to bridge the gap between a pure academic and the community while contributing in very important initiative. And I can say that we're really pleased to work with KFL and a public health, and looking forward to sharing the outcome of the project, which could shape better public health strategy for years to come.
Well, Farouzan, thank you for that bit of an overview, and you summed it up very, very well. What made you want to be, put your name forward to be in part of the PhD Community Initiative in the first place?
Well, last year I've heard from some of PhD students that it has huge impacts on making this, filling this gap between the pure academic and involving in the our community. So I was excited to participate in this year.
And I think that's an important point, that we have this program. Like you said, it's filling a gap, because you're all very good at what you do in your research, but sometimes you don't always realize that the skills that you are learning in doing your degree can be transferred into other areas and can be very, very helpful. And we have, there's a lot of great community organizations here in Kingston. And so it was a nice way of that balance between, here, I've got these skills, let me help you in something that you're finding difficult to do yourself, or you need more assistance with. And so it's a nice little partnership there, but also an amazing learning opportunity for each of you. Cynthia, why did you want to be part of the PhD Community Initiative?
Thank you for your question. This is a great opportunity for us to have an impact to the community, or it is about practicing what you learn in the school into the community. So changing your expertise or skill into the practice, and as well as this, a great opportunity for learning, as well as a chance to make also a meaningful contribution to public as well. So yeah, that's why I wanted to be part of this community, as well as it gives you the opportunity to work as a team, which is a good skill to also develop in. Yeah.
Right, great. And Priyanka, what about you?
I do resonate with Cynthia and Farouzan, because I think for me the main 2 points were to definitely bridge the gap, to see, because I do work in the lab, and then how do I give back to the community where I've been working for 4 years now? So I think one of the main reasons was definitely to give back to the community. And secondly, I would say it was to learn more about community engagement, or how to work with a community partner, leadership, interdisciplinary collaboration. So I think it was also more for myself in terms of professional and career growth, and it was I can help a community as well as improve myself as a PhD candidate. So I think it's a mix of both.
That's great. Kalichi?
Yeah, my response is similar to what my colleagues have also said. It's understanding that for myself, I've been in Kingston for like 4 years, and Kingston has been a home to me. So being part of this program would allow me to give back to Kingston, and being part of a program that will be helping people who live in Kingston. So I find that something that is very important. Also, like what everyone else has also said, you know, understanding that as graduate students, we are developing our research skills and all that, but it's also important to develop our industry-related skills, or basically take all that we've learned in research and try to apply them in day-to-day life, in trying to change day-to-day life of people in Kingston community. So that's something I found really interesting. I am, for one, a person who loves volunteering, so it was a beautiful opportunity for me to volunteer as a graduate student, and something that would have effect on the lives of people in Kingston while I'm still schooling in Kingston.
That's fantastic too. And Tanvi, I know you've snuck in as a master's student, but you know, which we do allow from time to time, even though it's called the PhD Community Initiative. What made you want to, at this stage in your education, wanted to be a part of a program like this?
I just thought that it was a really great opportunity for me to make connections. And as everybody's, all of my colleagues and team members said, we can be sometimes very tunnel visioned when we're working on our research and our projects. And so we tend to forget that there are other important professional skills that can be developed through programs like this. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was a really cool project to be working on. And I'm grateful that I was able to sneak in, even though I'm not a PhD student. But yeah, I've learned so much, and I'm really grateful that I am a part of this.
No, that's great. And what I've always loved when I listen to each iteration of the PhD Community Initiative and all the projects and things that got done at the end is how much you've all learned about that particular project and that particular community group. But I think some of you mentioned, you know, you've had to work together because you're all from different disciplines. And that's not always easy, because sometimes you think in different ways. And that's the uniqueness of this program, is bringing you from different disciplines, working on a project that is outside of academics per se. And how well do you work well together and with that community partner? Because it's very easy to sometimes go to a community partner and say, this is what we think you should be doing, instead of listening to the community partner and say, oh, what would you like us, what would you like help in? And sometimes that's not easy for a grad student, because you've got some great ideas and you want to impress those. But part of being in business or anything like that, you've got to listen to who you're working for. And in this case, it's your community partner. So you may have some great ideas and they say, yeah, go for it. And sometimes they say, no, I want you to do it this way, in which case you have to learn, okay, so how do we pivot to be able to do it that way and still make it work? So well done for all of you putting your hand up to do this. So with that, though, we know why you're in the program. Who can tell me about a bit more about what is this specific project that you're working with for KFL and A Public Health? And what have they asked you to do?
I can take the lead on that, if that's okay. And then I would love if my team members would chime in if I'm missing out on anything. So the purpose of our project, it is to assess the knowledge and perceptions of post-secondary students around IMD, invasive meningococcal disease. The community of Kingston, we've had a couple of cases in the past year. And so it's important for the public health to understand what kind of efforts they need to do in order to basically design their health promotion projects related to this very deadly disease. And so our focus is developing and implementing recruitment strategies for the invasive meningococcal disease survey. And as I mentioned before, we're targeting first and second year post-secondary students at Queen's as well as St. Lawrence College. And the insight that the survey will provide, it will be crucial and very helpful for the public health unit to develop and implement strategies that are effective and something that can reach the students and educate the young adults of the community.
So if your target audience is, you know, post-secondary, what kind of questions are you asking? Because some of them probably don't even know what meningococcal disease is. So what kind of questions are you asking? And is it more for an awareness? The survey is more to a bit of an awareness thing. What are you trying to do there? And what are you trying to ask these students?
So basically, the questions is, first of all, trying to find out if they've even received the vaccine. That's one of the crucial questions. But then again, trying to find out if they're actually aware of the disease itself and how the disease can be spread, and if they are aware of things to do to protect themselves from the disease. So it's more or less trying to get their perception of how they are aware of IMD.
Okay, and Tanvi mentioned there's been a few cases here in Kingston already. I shouldn't say only a few cases, because one case is one too many. But why the sudden urgency from KFNL Public Health to find out now what the perception and awareness of this disease? Have they talked about that to you?
So I wouldn't say this is the first time they're putting out feelers to know if students are aware of this. I know they have a steering committee where they are working with them, with people from Queen's University, from SLC, and from the Royal Military College. They have that in place. And I think they've also put out like surveys and things like that to find out awareness. And it's just so our role here is just to help them get the message out, reach more audience, and get more people aware to help them plan better. So this wouldn't be the first time they're doing this. We're only trying to make it better for them, sort of.
So Priyanka, maybe I'll ask you this. In the survey itself, are they hoping to find out ways of what will make this population, this target audience, take note? Are they some of the sorts of things that they're looking to find out? You know, what is the best way to reach this audience?
Yes, in a way, because to answer that question, in the survey, they do also have a video which talks about like how it is a contagious disease as well.
Right.
And students who live in the residence, as well as they have, are like they're hanging out in the common, like the cafeteria or in the canteen. So that could be a common spot for them to like, for the disease to spread. So the survey kind of focuses on how like you should be careful and it also addresses questions, or just like a straightforward yes or no question related to symptoms and the pathophysiology. Like, so if you have so-and-so symptoms, you need to be careful, get yourself checked. It talks about the vaccination status, like have you ever received vaccination for meningococcal B vaccine? Because I think last year there was a drive that they had done here by the student community and the student wellness center themselves, and the numbers were not that great. So this survey, again, is also to get more students to be aware that there is a specific vaccine for IMD, and it's better to get vaccinated rather than like face the symptoms and go through all the consequences later. And as a student, I think it's difficult to live in a silo. You have to interact. You are in a classroom with a different, like, I would say at least like 100 students in the same room. And you cannot avoid and say, like, I'm going to be isolated and just stay by myself. And it's not fair, and it shouldn't be as well as an undergrad student when you're exploring all the different opportunities. So I think the survey is just to create an awareness that enjoy, have fun, but also be mindful of the symptoms and get vaccinated. And I think it also talks about the number of vaccine doses, because you can get up to 2 to 3 just as a prevention. So it talks about if you've received, I think it's better to get a second dose to increase your memory towards the bacteria itself. And other than that, they also talk about the basic inquiries, like, are you an international or domestic student? And like, where do you reside? Because if it is in a housing or in a dorm, then you are like more sustainable to get it.
Right, right. So with this particular project, I mean, clearly there's lots to do in the survey. What have each of you done? What are your roles? Because I know everyone will have a different role to play. So how did you figure out who is doing what in this particular project?
I would love to answer that question, because I'm saying this because I'm very proud for I'm proud and also lucky that I've been assigned to this group. And so it wasn't really difficult for us to find out who gets to do what. First of all, we have this amazing team that works where we have a team leader every month and a scribe every month. So everyone gets to play the team leader, like the chairman of the group.
Brilliant.
Yes, and so you get to notice different sort of leadership styles and all that, and everyone gets to play the role of a scribe or a secretary. You get to learn all that skills. And then when it comes to assigning roles and all that, we would have our meetings and we'll decide, right, these are the tasks that needs to be done. And people will just say, well, I am very good at this, I'm happy to take this on. Or you say, I can walk up to this extent and I need someone to help me out with that. And that's right. Basically what has been happening. So we've not had any task that has been assigned to someone and the person had to struggle. It's always people jumping up and saying, I'm very good at this, leave this right. to me, and I'm ready to do it. And that has been what has been pushing our group together. And as I said, it makes me very happy to be part of this particular group.
Well, that's really nice that you've all got on so well. So, Sintayahu, you could talk about that. What are some of the challenges you've had so far? Because you don't have long to do this project.
Yeah, thanks. I would be happy to respond for this question. Yeah, as my team mentioned, the main goal of this project is to assess knowledge and perception of the post-secondary students at Queen's Central Arts College and also Royal Military College from these three institutions. So while this initiative provides with invaluable learning opportunities and a chance to make also a meaningful contribution to public and student community health, it has not been without its challenge. So we can view these challenges from two perspectives: team-related challenges and project-related challenges. So one of the challenge of team-related is like the management and the workload, the time management and the workload.
Right.
So balancing the workload of this project or this initiative with our PhD research project, which are really demanding, has been particularly tough. So since this initiative is voluntary, we initially actually agreed to dedicate 5 to 7 hours per week for this project. However, there have been and also will be weeks when the demand exceeds these commitments and leaving us a little bit overburdened. So this is especially difficult when considering additional responsibility outside of academics, like family responsibility and personal obligations. Mm. So as Kelechi mentioned, as a mitigation for this workload, we have kind of strategy like creating a realistic timeline with clear milestone and also deadline for the project, distributing tasks among team members to reduce the workload for individuals.
Right.
So these were the main mitigation strategy we have been using for the workload. When it comes to project-related challenges, I can say recruiting participants for the study has been significant challenge, particularly engaging a diverse and a representative group of undergraduate students from Queen's, SLC and RMC. Mm-hmm. Really challenging. And as you well aware, many students have busy schedules and the competing priorities, which can make it challenging to secure their participation in this survey. The other main challenge is maybe the ethical and the bureaucratic hurdles has been significant challenge, because securing ethics approval from multiple institutions like from SLC and RMC, it consumed much time and also it really required persistent and patience. Yeah, and there are also resource constraints which I can mention that.
Well, ethics is never easy, but unfortunately it is something we need to tick off the list, otherwise we're not allowed to use or go forward. So in terms of the chat, I think I heard it correctly, with the challenge of, you know, getting the survey to the people who we want to fill it in, it's not easy. Maybe Firuzan or Tanvi, how are you going to get this survey to this particular group of students? What are your thoughts so far? Because I think it was Priyanka Kalichi talked about you might be in, you know, this group is very much a lot of the times those that are in residences, so there's areas where they can meet. Are you thinking about putting posters up in the dining halls or having you out there and handing out little forms and saying, look, we would really love you to fill this form and here's the QR code to access it? What are some of the ways that you're thinking about of actually getting this survey into the hands of the students that you want to answer it?
I can speak about this. So as a group, we've brainstormed a lot of different ways. And so far, we have connected with different sort of gatekeepers across the campus who would be helpful to us in getting the word out and spreading the survey to the students. And so we have connected with residence coordinators, we've connected with academic coordinators, program coordinators. We have a digital version of the poster with a QR code in it and a clickable link. And we also have one of our other team members who isn't here with us today, Sebastian, but he has been going around the campus and has been actually putting up physical posters.
Good job.
That we've printed.
So in the cold, that's brave.
Yes. So those have been our main strategies. And as well as we're constantly on the lookout for people that can help us, we have connected with off-campus housing coordinators as well. And that has been our strategy so far, and we have been receiving some responses. We have started to see a little bit of a positive response.
Right.
And as soon as we have a green signal from St. Lawrence College as well as RMC, we would be sort of implementing the same strategy there as well.
So, Farouzan, with that, I mean, yes, the survey is getting out there, but what for you guys would be considered a success rate of surveys? Because surveys are only as good as the number of people that fill it in, really. And to help KFL and A Public Health, we want a certain amount of students that have responded.
That's true. And I wanted to actually, before I talk more, added some other doors that we are looking maybe open for putting the survey there. Like we are making a list of program coordinators. They may help in different departments to distribute the survey, so they may have more impact on each department's students. So
right.
We will get more responses. And regarding to our team, I think every step is counting as a success, because already we have made lots of skills like team working. Even it has impact on improve our skills in leading the teams, writings and everything. So each step is a success for us. But regarding to KLFNA, Public Health, I believe for them as well, even finding the barriers and how they can open more doors, making more connection, it can be a success. Or which part of the community is responding to the survey. Even this small information can impact a huge impact on the community.
I'm sure in terms of KFLNH Public Health, they're going to be really pleased with you. Hopefully you'll get the numbers to get some good data for them to use on this particular topic, but you're also going to give them also a plan that they can use elsewhere. So well done to all of you.
Thank you. You must be
very proud of yourselves. And I'm looking forward to, when you've finished your project, listening in to what you say in the capstone event, because I always enjoy listening to that. You know what, everyone, you know, we've come to the end, but I do want to thank you all so, so much for coming on and talking about the program itself, but your particular project, because it is important. You know, meningococcal disease is not a good one to have around. So the work you're doing is going to help the safety of our community. So thank you very much for doing that. And best of luck for finishing this project and also, of course, with your own research degrees as well. And thank you for spending your own time to help on something like this apart from just your studies, because I know that's not easy as a grad student juggling everything. But the fact that you it is a voluntary position, everyone, the fact that you volunteered to put in this amount of time each week is fantastic to hear. So Farouzan, Cynthia, Tanvi, Kalichi and Priyanka, and I know Jeannie is listening in, thank you all so, so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray. Grad Chat.
Grad Chat. Today on Wings, something to dream about.
Good health and sanitation, good housing, good roads, communications, education, law and order. It sounds like a utopia these days, doesn't it? When I was growing up, we really believed it was achievable, you know?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Suki Wessling from The Babblery. This is the second in a two-part series about Caribbean feminist Peggy Antrobus. The first episode, Our Collective Well-Being, features Peggy's thoughts on Mia Amor Motley, Prime Minister of the Caribbean nation of Barbados. Peggy is 90, and when I spoke to her in spring 2025, she had just returned home from a stay in the hospital. But if that makes it sound as if her intellectual vigor and expansive curiosity has been diminished, this episode will dispel any such notions. Talking to Peggy about the region where she has spent her life and career is like wading in the sea itself. Our conversation wove in and out of what Peggy refers to as her ongoing critique of colonialism, imperialism, and extractivism.
Third world feminism is very different from North American feminism, you know that.
Starting with this idea of a different kind of feminism, Peggy went back to the beginning, back when she thought that feminism was an American invention having nothing to do with women in her region.
So my background is really in the Caribbean in development and wanted to contribute some way to Caribbean development. I'm from that generation on the eve of independence, you know. So we're all fired up and wanted to contribute. So this is the reason I chose to do an economics degree. And I got a scholarship to university, the British University. I read for economics and because I thought that would help me to contribute. My family is a family of public servants, you know, worked with the colonial office and colonial administration. So very much focused on development. When we talk about development in those days, we're always talking about socioeconomic development. Development is never about, you know, real estate. So I chose to do economics, and then I found out that economics degree at a university in Britain did not help me understand Caribbean economies because they're based on a whole different set of theories and assumptions. Don't take account of colonial relations, right, and colonial structures. So that was the first thing I had to unlearn. Anyway, over a long, you know, trial and error in a sense. I mean, apart from that decision, I never made any other decision about what I would do. I just kind of was going along. I had very good luck and good fortune. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time and had the opportunities to do some things that built on each other, you know? So starting off with thinking I would be in public finance, finding out I couldn't do that, going into social work. Anyway, finally, by chance, I was asked to work on women's issues. This was the beginning of International Women's Year, which was 1975. I think International Women's Year meant something very different to people, women from the South. You know, for women like myself, it was a big thing. It was an opportunity for the first time for women from the South to be involved in these meetings and under the auspices of the United Nations to focus on our issues. This had never happened before, and it was not only happening because of the year, but the year became a decade. So we had a decade to really get to know each other, people from Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, Latin America for the first time, opportunities to meet on a consistent basis around the UN agenda, which was also our agenda. So it was really an incredible time, and it really became my life's work.
Like many women of her generation, Peggy Antrobus developed an early suspicion of feminism based on its popular characterization. Once she understood the foundation of feminist perspective, she was able to understand how it applied to the lives of Caribbean women.
At the beginning, I didn't know much about feminism. I used to distance myself from a feminism that was about what I now characterize as North American feminism, which of course is a misrepresentation. I only found out later on that it was a misrepresentation. The representation then was white, middle class, lesbian, man-hating, bra-burning, right? Does it sound familiar? And then I found out, no, that's not really what it's about, but it has to be denigrated like that. It has to be characterized and trivialized like that because it's really too powerful. And we can't let women get the feeling that they have all this power and that they understand the way that power structures work. That's very dangerous. So I think feminism continues to be misrepresented and also embraced. Different feminisms, not one. It's very convenient that they're different feminisms because you could always pit one set of feminists against the other. Marxist feminists and radical feminists. And anyway, the point is that my feminism has always been grounded in Caribbean history, even though I learned a lot from my North American friends. I say that because, you know, people like to say that, you know, people like myself are influenced by the North. I don't see that. I think we influence the North, at least in my own experience. I have influenced my feminist friends. We influence each other. We help each other understand that feminism is not just about patriarchy, that it's also about racism and class and colonialism.
Place is at the center of the way Peggy Antrobus expresses her political and feminist views.
You see, from the South, the world looks very different. There's a whole different perspective, a completely different perspective. I know that North Americans think that you're the center of the world, of the universe, but from where I stand, you're not. Although the influence is so pervasive, it's overwhelming.
Peggy Antrobus in her 90 years has developed a long view of the place the Caribbean holds in the world economy, always through the lens of a feminist from the global South. She says that in the 1970s, she and her fellow Caribbean activists were so hopeful for the development that would help their countries heal from colonialism. But few people now remember that the world economic system was not designed to help the former colonies, but rather to extract from them.
Coming out of the most recent decades since 1980, people have forgotten about that. So going into independence, that whole anti-colonial struggle, everybody understood that. And then somehow in the 1980s, not somehow, you know, with the rise of Reagan and Thatcher, all of that was lost in 1980. 84, in the Caribbean, our leaders all embraced this new so-called Washington Consensus. And in doing that, they basically abandoned what they came out of colonialism to do, which is to promote broad-based socioeconomic development in these islands that had been colonial, meaning a kind of development that prioritizes or understands that education and health and sanitation and housing are all the foundation for economic growth. An economy that's healthy for everybody, you know, in which everybody, every person has a chance to survive and thrive. And the opportunities to do that, you know, through good health and sanitation, affordable housing, good roads, communications, education, law and order. It sounds like a utopia these days, doesn't it? When I was growing up, it wasn't a utopia. It was achievable. When I was growing up, we really believed it was achievable, you know. I know it's possible. It's not utopia. It's only people are saying utopia because They never knew it. Maybe they never knew it. And I knew it. That's how I grew up. That's what inspired me.
When I met with Peggy Antrobus, we initially planned to talk mostly about Mia Mottley, Prime Minister of Barbados. Our conversation went far afield, but I wanted to include a little bit of Peggy's analysis of the Bridgetown Initiative, a proposal to reform the global financial architecture, named for Bridgetown, the capital city of Barbados.
So the Bridgetown Initiative really is a very sophisticated way of putting together issues of economy and ecology. So that Bridgetown initiative is really visionary in that she understands the link between the climate crisis and the economic crisis and the debt crisis. It's a world financial system that is created in the aftermath of World War II. The system that we have now, which is collapsing, or which has probably collapsed. I mean, Trump has probably taken a chainsaw or a hammer or whatever to it. But that whole system was created after World War II. And America took a leading role in creating that system. The institutions were institutions like International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which is to make sure that it was possible to deal with issues of debt. So basically, if a country was in debt, the International Monetary Fund would lend the country money, which the country, of course, has to pay back. But basically, lending money to the country so that the country could pay the debt. So the beneficiary of that, of the IMF, is actually the lenders, right? Then you had the World Bank to deal with developing countries, lending money for development, a kind of a international Marshall Plan, supposedly. But again, you see, it doesn't take into account the issue of race and colonialism. So it's not quite right to think of the World Bank as being the equivalent of the Marshall Plan. The investment in Europe is also going to benefit investors in the United States. It's a kind of a mutual thing. It's among equals, right? Everybody benefits. But with the World Bank, you have a hierarchy. So the World Bank, the top of the hierarchy, really doing what the former colonial power, the powerful countries, need to be done. Because the powerful countries understand the need to develop other countries so that those other countries could buy their products. The World Bank is in the interest of its investors. It's just, by the way, countries could benefit also, because investors want countries to develop, because investors want airports, roads, houses, factories, you know, access to raw material, ports. It's in the interest of capital that the rest of the world be developed too.
Peggy was part of a contingent of educated Caribbeans who came together in the 1970s to form a vision of what development of the region could look like. She describes today's situation from the view of what could have been.
It's basically a world economic order that is based on the colonial powers still in charge, still calling the shots, laying down the rules, the conditions under which you can borrow. And what that system has led to, a few things. First of all, quite apart from the climate crisis, which has led directly to that, because it has facilitated extractivism and the kind of economic growth that has really led to the climate crisis. There's no question about that. But it has also led to increasing inequality and the continuation of dependence. It has led to continuation of the same colonial relations that we were supposed to have ended with independence. And it has led to a world order where, you know, the North and the South, the rich and the poor, but not just between countries, but within countries. So in the South, you also have that world order represented in every country. And the thing about climate change and these small countries, we're the most vulnerable, because you're talking about our entire country. And it's not just an economy now. It's not just the destruction of a coastline. It's the entire country. Barbados is so small that the entire island could be washed out, like the Pacific Islands. So it's an economic order that is not designed for us, but is doing enormous harm. And it's an existential crisis. So in the 70s was a time when a lot of the newly independent countries of Africa and the Caribbean were coming into their own and finding membership in the United Nations. They found a voice.
From her earliest experiences, Peggy saw the promise of the United Nations for small island countries. But the tensions of the Cold War raised the stakes for the large nations, who had no qualms about making pawns of the post-colonial nations.
They found a voice, but again, not quite part of it, because in the United Nations, every country has a voice, except with the Security Council, of course. They re-inscribe the hierarchy there with the power. But anyways, the newly independent countries of Africa, the Caribbean, Asia, began calling for a new international economic order, NIEO. That's when I first got involved in working on women's issues for the government of Jamaica. So they had an international platform, And there was a movement, and the movement was speaking with one voice.
On Wings, you're listening to an interview with Dr. Peggy Antrobus, Caribbean feminist elder, about her life and work. This is your host, Suki Wessling of The Babblery.
We actually had a North-South dialogue at the UN. And all this was, by the way, was against the backdrop of the Cold War. So you also had, the backdrop was an East-West divide. So against this backdrop, maybe because of the Cold War, these countries had a very strong voice because there was a battle going on between the Soviet Union and the West as to, you know, where would these new voices go? So that was all part of the Cold War and that part of the whole anti-communist thing. And the whole thing about communism and capitalism had nothing to do with us in the South. We got drawn into it. The Grenada Revolution was a victim of that. You know, it's not our struggle. It's not our battle. Our struggle was just to get some justice for our countries, you know. And then in the 70s, we were finding we're up against these structures. So behind that whole call for a new international economic order was actually about trade. It was actually about the relationship between manufactured products and raw material. Because what was happening was that the price of raw materials was being kept artificially low so that the people that manufactured the products would make extraordinary profits. So for them to be profitable, they have to have raw materials as cheap as possible, labor as cheap as possible. So what would happen is that the South would be producing all the raw material, you know, the sugar and the cocoa and the oil and all of that rubber and all of that raw material. And the North would import that raw material and they would manufacture things. We're talking about the days in which, you know, the United States was a big manufacturing country. Germany, huge. You know, and that was the model. Everybody wanted to be a manufacturing country. But the South is being prevented from being like that because, as somebody said to me at Harvard once, and who would buy our stuff? If you produce your own stuff, who would buy our stuff? And that kind of took me aback. I mean, why should our job be to buy American stuff? We were not put on this earth to buy American stuff, surely. We are not here to be consumers, right? Of American products. I wasn't a consumer, I was a citizen. Suki, it's very difficult to control me because I have so much to say, you know? You have to restrain me.
I definitely didn't want to restrain her. I asked Peggy about her current home, Barbados, and how she thinks the young people are doing.
I would say that one of the problems with youth in the Caribbean is there are not a lot of opportunities in the Caribbean for young people. Always, young people have to go overseas. So we have a large diaspora. And it's partly because these islands are just so small and the opportunities are so limited, you know, so they go overseas. But in my day, in my youth, we had something to dream about, you know, which was independence. To me, the problem with young people in the Caribbean today is American culture. We are so exposed to it. You know, they are, through social media, they are so exposed to materialism, to consumerism. I think that's right. There's a whole set of problems because we cannot continue along this road of materialism and consumerism. We can't, you know? I mean, when I was growing up, we still had kerosene lamps and candles and coal pots and no indoor plumbing, you know. So there was a lot of that stuff that was needed. Now people have it and they take it for granted. I remember my son complaining that there was no hot water in the tap when he was an adolescent. And I said, Jared, I didn't know that hot water came out of taps when I was growing up. I didn't even know that. It's so taken for granted now. We didn't have Nike's. Sneakers. Nobody wanted Nike sneakers. We didn't have internet.
Raising children and watching the new young generation has also given Peggy perspective on the blinders installed by her own childhood in a past where racism was not called out.
You know, we used to go to our old movies and watch the old Tarzan movies without realizing that that was part of our brainwashing. We didn't know. I did a course once, a weekend once on institutionalized racism, and for the first time realized that the things that I grew up with that seemed very benign to me were not so benign after all. I mean, I grew up with Tarzan movies. I didn't know what they represented and what function they were supposed to play. I grew up singing the songs of Stephen Foster, way down upon this Swanee River, long, you know, all the nostalgia for the South. I did all that, not knowing what I was talking about, not knowing what it represented. You know, oh, darkies, how my heart grows weary. Here am I, an African descent. Oh, darkies, how my heart grows weary, longing for the old days at home. All that good old stuff down on the plantation, how I'm longing for it now that I'm lost in New York ghetto. But in the Caribbean, I mean, I grew up really believing, I was such a good colonial. I mean, really believed that what was best for Britain was best for us. I mean, my parents worked for the colonial office. My education was entirely British. I knew everything about the British Isles and I knew nothing about the Caribbean, nothing. So my geography was British geography. My history was British history. When I was growing up, my curriculum was all set by Oxford and Cambridge. You know, and it's the same curriculum. The children in Nigeria, South Africa, Australia, India, Pakistan. I have friends from India. We kind of laugh about it. I honestly believed that what was best for Britain was best for us. I believed in the mother country. Going to England for a start, you find out right away. That's no mother country. They don't regard you as their favorite children. I never knew about racism until I went to England. I didn't know I was black. I had a clue. I didn't know anything about slavery growing up in the Caribbean. Can you believe it? I had to find out. I didn't know I was black growing up. I had to find out. And that's one of the reasons why I feel so fortunate, you know, is as an adult, you can deal with those things when you're an adult. But as a child growing up, being made to feel that there's something wrong with something, you're somehow less, and all the messages are telling you that.
The second Trump administration, Peggy says, is starting a whole new chapter in Caribbean-American relations.
The Caribbean has always had deep roots in America. Our diaspora is there. I mean, we all have family there. I have a daughter, grandchildren, all have family there. So we're so deeply connected. But I don't think that I wouldn't go. Personally, I'm not even going to go and see my grandchildren right now. If I were younger, I would not be going there now. Least of all to migrate. You'd have to be mad to even think about it. I think you have to take a very long view right now. You have to believe in the resilience of nature. Some people, I'm one of them, who thinks that the only thing that will stop the madness is the climate, Mother Nature. I honestly believe that the only thing that's going to stop this is Mother Nature. So I'm waiting for some kind of, you know, cataclysm.
I asked Peggy how she thinks we will move forward from here, and she brought it back to where she comes from.
My ancestors went through slavery. They went through the Middle Passage. You know, when you read about that, you wonder how anybody ever survived. How did anybody ever survive that? Well, and now again, I know how they survived. Women. Women's love, that's it. The historians don't write about that. My hope comes from my own history, you know, and my non-attachment to material stuff and my understanding that, you know, the most important things are not things. You know, money is important, but it's not how people survive in the Caribbean. Norman Manley, who is the father of Michael Manley, used to say, the poor survive on the generosity of the poor. Not the generosity of the rich. People help each other, you know. And I think about Caribbean history, coming out of slavery, right? Coming off the plantation. They had a market on a Saturday. They helped each other. In the Caribbean, we have this concept of family that goes beyond kinship. We talk about people as aunts and uncles who are our parents' best friends. We have the concept of family, F-A-M-B-L-I, family, you know. And we look out for each other. That's how we survive slavery. And, you know, women would pick up those broken bodies and take care of them. That's the idea, the same idea that poor people kind of, they band together and they guarantee loans for each other. My mother-in-law never worked outside the home, so she never had any cash. But she used to guarantee loans for people. She used to call the hardware merchants and say, so-and-so wants some lumber or some galvanized or some paint. And we use the word trust. We trust her, you know, let her have what she needs. And they would take my mother-in-law's word for it. And those women never reneged on their loan. They never let down my mother-in-law. So I think, again, coming out of slavery, we know in the Caribbean how to manage without cash. I mean, sometimes it's exchange, you know, exchanging things, but sometimes it's based on people's relationships of caring. When I was growing up, I mean, you won't find anybody homeless or starving on the street in the Caribbean. You'll always be able to get a meal somewhere or something. Somebody is going to give you something. And remittances, that's where remittances come in. I mean, one of my rare fears about the collapse of the U.S. economy is what will happen to remittances. I mean, there's whole communities in the Caribbean that depend on those remittances. You know, people that go to the United States and work hard and send money home to their family. They do all sorts of menial things. I mean, they're all sorts of terrible, terrible work so that they can send money to their children and their families. That's how their families survive. And it's not considered charity, you know? It's your family. And when those people come back to the Caribbean on holiday, they're treated like royalty. And it compensates for being demeaned and treated with contempt in the ghettos, you know? So they come back. I know a man in Miami who's a gardener from Jamaica. Every year he buys a lot of toys and he goes back to Jamaica, to his village, and he's like Santa Claus. It's just wonderful. It's how people survive and thrive.
During our conversation, Peggy Antrobus pointed out that island nation residents are the most vulnerable to climate change. But at the same time, she welcomes Mother Nature as a power that might finally bring some change.
And when we had our last shot at creating the kind of world we wanted before Reagan came and took it all away, our leaders gave it away. They all bought into this nonsense about Washington consensus. It wasn't a consensus. To me, a consensus is something that emerges out of a conversation. So we have a consensus. No. But the U.S. Treasury defined the Washington consensus. And then the discourse about the Washington consensus and the Thatcher picking it up and saying it's the only alternative, you know, it's the only thing. And here we are today. Everybody believes it's the only way to organize an economy. But I think the climate is going to do it. The climate is going to speak ultimately. You know, Mother Nature. Ultimately, Mother Nature is going to take charge. Hold on to part of it. Part of the mother. Remember that we are part of the mother. The hearts I've been chasing.
My deepest thanks to Dr. Peggy Antrobus for speaking with me. Her experience includes many decades of work on global women's issues, development, and the economy. She co-founded Dawn, Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era. Find more of our conversation on wings.org. The song Stay Alive by Holly Cook is courtesy of the freemusicarchive.org. I'm Suki Wessling.
Wings thanks all our supporters and contributors, past and present, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wing Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres.